VOA Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis, host for this special edition of PCUSA. On this special program, we're going to examine the Republican Party, a look at its history, where it stands today, and what's ahead for the party in the future. To help us on this journey is Ramesh Panuru, a conservative Republican and visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies the future of conservatism with a particular focus on health care, economic policy, and constitutionalism. In addition, Mr. Panuru is a senior editor for National Review, where he has covered national politics and public policy for 20 years, as well as a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion and a contributor to CBS News and a frequent contributor to various television news programs. And not to leave out, Mr. Panuru is an author. Among his writings, he authored The Party of Death, The Democrats, The Media, The Courts, and The Disregard for Human Life. Also joining me on the panel today is VOA senior correspondent Brian Padden. Well, welcome to you both. First, let's look at how the Republican Party came to be. It is often called the GOP, short for Grand Old Party, and was founded in 1854 as a coalition opposing the extension of slavery into Western territories. The GOP fought to protect the rights of African Americans. Over the course of the Civil War, Lincoln and other Republicans began to see the abolition of slavery as a strategic move to help them win the war. In 1863, President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, and by the end of the war, the Republican majority in Congress spearheaded the passage of the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery. Well, today, the GOP is generally socially conservative, favors smaller government, less regulation, lower taxes, and less federal intervention in the economy. Well, that's just a snapshot look at the GOP. Mr. Panuru, how have Republicans' values changed over the years from what they originally stood for, or have they really changed?
There's a lot of questions these days about the stability of American government going forward, but one thing that's been very stable is that we've had two large parties. But what those parties stand for shifts over time. So in the 1900s, the early 1900s, the Republican Party was a protectionist party on trade, and the Democratic Party was a more free trading party. More recently, that's been reversed. The Republicans have been the more free trade party. Now, with President Trump, in a way, we're going back to the future because President Trump has led the Republican Party back to its protectionist roots, one might say. So there are issues where the party's position sort of ebbs and flows.
Okay, and Brian, would you like to jump in?
You know, much of the history of the party, in addition to trade and the economy, there's been a whole cultural aspect of the Republicans being anti-slavery, and then in the late 1960s, developing its Southern strategy in which it pushed for states' rights and resisted somewhat against civil rights for African Americans, bringing the traditionally Democratic South into the Republican fold. How important has this cultural aspect been in forming the current Republican Party?
Well, I would say social conservatism in general, which I would think of as more things like opposition to abortion, support for religious freedom, than I think matters having to do with civil rights, a strong component in the Republican Party. I think historically, the sort of backlash against the 60s, social change happening too fast, and including civil rights, that was very important in forming the Republican majority in the 70s, 80s, and to a little bit in the 90s. But I think a lot of that sort of petered out in the mid-90s. And since then, what we've come to call the religious right has become a more and more important part of Republican Party politics. And you can see that even today. Donald Trump has broken with a lot of previous Republicans on a lot of issues, but he hasn't on abortion. He himself personally in the past was in favor of legal abortion, but he has been, as president, completely in lockstep with the anti-abortion groups. By contrast, if you think about the Republican Party's history on civil rights, a lot of conservative Republicans from a generation ago were bitterly hostile to affirmative action, to the idea that in college admissions or federal contracts or employment, there should be some way of remedying past discrimination or ensuring diversity, even if that meant that whites or white men were at a disadvantage because of those efforts. That's really fallen out of the Republican discourse, and even the Trump administration has not been as eager to revive that fight as, say, the Republicans of the mid-1990s when Newt Gingrich was the Speaker of the House and leading them.
Even early on, Republicans will become increasingly associated with big business and financial interests, as you mentioned, in the industrialized North. So how did this affect the Republicans' focus on African Americans in the South, and what were the Democrats doing at this time?
Well, the Republican Party actually had a pretty glorious history on civil rights, as we were discussing earlier, starting with, of course, the Civil War and the founding of the party as an anti-slavery party, the shepherding through of the Reconstruction Amendments. And the Republican Party was, for a long time, the party that African Americans called home. Frederick Douglass said, you know, the Republican Party is the deck, all else the sea. But that started to change around the time of the New Deal and the Great Depression, when Franklin Roosevelt was seen as somebody who was helping everybody in the country, but particularly those who were struggling through the Depression. And then even more in the 1960s, congressional Republicans were actually more eager, more willing to support the Civil Rights Acts than congressional Democrats were. But there were high-profile Democrats who were for it and Republicans who were against it. So in 1964, right after the Civil Rights Act is passed, the Republicans nominate a conservative states' rights advocate, Barry Goldwater, who's against the Civil Rights Act, and Lyndon Johnson, the Democrat, is the person who signed the Civil Rights Act. And that helps to finished the job that FDR had started of moving African Americans into the Democratic Party, where they've stayed very solidly ever since. Business has remained a pretty strong Republican coalition member throughout this whole period, with brief exceptions. And sometimes that's worked to make the Republican Party more moderate on some things, because a lot of businesses don't think of ideological crusades as being good for business. But sometimes it has worked to make the Republican Party seem out of touch and too tied to the interests of the very rich or big business owners. And actually, one of the paradoxes that we are dealing with right now is part of the way Trump got elected was by promising to be a different kind of a Republican, to be a more worker-friendly Republican and a less big business-friendly Republican. He has not wholly delivered on that promise. And in a lot of ways, his policy record on things like taxes is a traditional business-friendly Republican's record. So, for example, he cut the corporate tax rate by quite a bit.
And also just a little bit of history, looking at the 1860s up to 1936, the Democratic Party of small government became the party of the big government. I think you kind of alluded to that earlier. And the Republican Party of big government became rhetorically committed to curbing federal power. So why this switch, and is it switched back now?
So it's almost as though the parties traded ideologies and traded voters in a lot of ways. From the late 19th century into really the 1960s, the Northeast was more Republican-friendly and the South was solidly Democratic. And now it's more or less the reverse. The Northeast is almost solid Democratic and the South is dominated by Republicans. And I think it just has to do with kind of contingency and the power of the two-party system to sort of assimilate challenges. And over time, parties just sort of, they just change.
In many countries, different parties don't have identities. They don't have significantly different platforms on economic or social agendas. It's more about ethnic identity or groupings or people in power. How different is the U.S. in that you have two parties with distinct different approaches towards economy, national security, culture?
There is a fair amount of distinction between the parties on questions of policy, questions of political philosophy. That hasn't always been the case. So historically, 30, 40 years ago, It was much more regionally dominated, and there were liberals in the Republican Party, there were conservatives in the Democratic Party, but both parties were politically mixed. And that over time changed. And the odd thing is, actually, looking back at it, political scientists and a lot of commentators back when you had these parties that were not philosophically and ideologically distinct said, well, we need distinct parties. We need to have different viewpoints competing openly, and then we'll have accountability. But as it turned out, having more sort of coherent, unified parties seems in a lot of ways to have made people less happy with the state of our politics.
Are we now moving into more of a identity-based party system? As you said, Donald Trump has kind of flipped the script on some of these traditional Republican values and platforms.
So the end point of the parties becoming distinct was that the parties became identities for people in a way that competes with and is up alongside identities like where you're from or what your religion is. The difference now is really easily seen when you look at surveys about how you would feel if your son or daughter were to marry somebody from the other party. And it turns out that that is becoming less and less popular and more controversial. Or to put it in terms maybe younger people would more relate to, would you be willing to date somebody of the other party? Now, in the past, that didn't matter so much. And there were a lot of politically mixed marriages, a lot of politically mixed neighborhoods. That is increasingly a thing of the past. We have more states that are landslide states. Fewer of them are seriously contested in the normal elections. Fewer counties are seriously contested. More counties are landslide counties.
And also, I just wanted to go back a little bit to the lead up to where we are today with President Trump and looking at some of the past Republican presidents. For instance, many Americans blamed Republicans for the stock market crash in 1929, which ushered in the Great Depression, which you talked about, and the dissatisfaction with Republicans allowed for Democrat Franklin D. Roosevelt to win the presidency. Then we have centrist Republican Dwight D. Eisenhower, who actively supported equal rights for women and African Americans. He held the presidency from 1953 to 1961. So can you tell us how his presidency was the catalyst for a resurgence of conservatism of the Republicans?
So Eisenhower took office after 20 solid years of Democrats being in the White House. FDR for an unprecedented 3.5 terms, and then Harry Truman, who had been his vice president for 1.5 terms following that. But Eisenhower was, I think, pretty shrewd in realizing that the transformation of American government that Franklin Roosevelt had wrought with the New Deal was not going to be rolled back. There were conservative Republicans who were very frustrated with Eisenhower because he wanted to preside over good times and basically not rock the boat, not roll back any of FDR's accomplishments, not get rid of things like Social Security or the Tennessee Valley Authority or other popular FDR innovations. That made Eisenhower popular, and he won 2 landslide elections. But the frustration that it caused on the right side of the Republican Party caused conservatives to organize to take over the Republican Party, give it more philosophical definition. And that's what then leads in 1964 to conservative Barry Goldwater becoming the Republican nominee and the party moving on to a more ideological conservative path.
What effect did the presidency of Richard Nixon, his policies and his ultimate resignation, what did that have on the Republican Party?
Well, Nixon's resignation in disgrace in 1974 led to a lot of panic among Republicans. Republicans lost big in the following elections. They lost 58 seats in the U.S. House in the 1974 elections held less than 3 months after Nixon's resignation. And there was even talk among Republicans at the time that the party maybe needed to change its name to get a new start, or the conservatives should start a third party and just break away from the Republican Party because it was hopeless. And yet, just a few years later, Ronald Reagan wins an electoral landslide, wins the presidency. The Republicans take the Senate for the first time since the 1950s. And it shows you, I think, how quickly parties can rebound if the voters are dissatisfied with the people in charge.
Okay, and we're going to stop there for a quick break. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Ramesh Panuru, visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies the future of conservatism with a particular focus on healthcare, economic policy, and constitutionalism. And joining me as a panelist is my colleague, VOA senior correspondent, Brian Padden. I'm Kim Lewis, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And a new VOA English app for both Android and Apple devices has been developed, and we encourage you to download and use them. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal fan, Joseph Kayunge Misiu from Nairobi, Kenya. Greetings, Joseph, and thank you for tuning in. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Now, returning to our topic of discussion, the Republican Party, past, present, and future. Now, you were talking about Ronald Reagan. Well, he won the presidency based on a platform of reducing the size of the federal government, and he also increased military spending when he became president. He spearheaded huge tax cuts and championed the free market with policies that became known as Reaganomics. So what was the general view of the party during this time, and how did this view change with George H.W. Bush?
So the Republican Party under Reagan was really on an upswing, and it felt confident. It was winning some big political victories. 1980, of course, Reagan wins, but in 1984, he wins a real landslide, getting about 59% of the vote, winning 49 of the 50 states, and really sort of triumphing politically. He really associated the Republican Party with a sort of problem-solving and forward-looking conservatism. The next president, George H.W. Bush, had been Reagan's vice president. He ran to succeed him in 1988 and largely ran as somebody who would continue the Reagan policies, maybe soften them here and there, trim here and there, but basically be a candidate of continuity. That was really important. It was important both because Bush had been a rival to Reagan. He'd run against him in 1980, so this was partly a way of saying, okay, this is what the Republican Party is going to stand for from now on. It's not just this one man, Ronald Reagan. This is a party definition. And then second, when Bush then won in a pretty convincing victory in 1988, it confirmed for a lot of Americans, Republicans and Democrats, again, it's not just Reagan who's so personally popular. It's this style of politics actually has a lot of Americans behind it. And so that becomes the way Republicans define themselves for a generation.
I also just wanted to touch lightly on George W. Bush. After President Clinton's run in the White House, the GOP recaptured it in 2000 with his election. Though his administration was popular, especially after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, he lost support during growing opposition to the war in Iraq and the faltering economy during the recession.
George W. Bush had a pretty steep descent politically during his second term in office, and it was a lot of it related to the quagmire in Iraq, where Americans not only came to believe that we had gone in under mistaken premises about weapons of mass destruction, but that we were not winning and that we didn't have a plan to win and that our leadership wasn't really being straight about that set of facts. Add to that the economic meltdown. You know, we have a recession that starts, as it turns out, we learn later, in December 2007, and then it becomes a real economic crisis in the fall of 2008, and you get the formula for Barack Obama to win a landslide election in 2008. By that time, George W. Bush is extremely unpopular. His something in the 29% of Americans approve of the job he's doing by that time. Since then, his popularity has rebounded a fair amount, which tends to happen to former presidents of all kinds in the United States. Americans seem to be pretty forgiving of their past leaders. But it creates a set of political problems where Republicans need to, after 2008, figure out where they stand in relation to George W. Bush. Do they want to be different kinds of Republicans, and in just what ways? And to some degree, this sets the stage for Donald Trump, because he can campaign as somebody who is in very important respects not like George W. Bush. He says that the Iraq War was a mistake. He even goes as far as saying, when he's running for president, that Bush lied us into that war. It turns out that Republican voters are not willing to hold that against him, and some of them are even okay with it because they, too, have turned against that war.
Trump's provocations aside, when he was running for president in 2016, he did flip on some traditional Republican platforms and positions. He sounded quite Republican in telling workers in these key states, rather than push for more government benefits, I'm going to bring back jobs. We want you to have jobs. That, in a way, is a more traditional Republican message. How would you describe his messaging during the 2016 campaign?
So I think that there was a mix of things that Trump was doing in 2016, and it ended up working quite well for him. Partly, he was exploiting the good opinion that a lot of Americans, and especially Republicans, have about successful businessmen. And he was able to do that in a way that the previous Republican nominee, Mitt Romney, had not been able to do in 2012. When Romney ran, he was also a successful businessman, but he was the kind of successful businessman to whom most people couldn't relate, because most people have only a hazy understanding of what somebody in the branch of finance that Romney made his career in actually do for a living. Whereas people thought they understood what Trump was doing. They thought of him as somebody who built things and then slapped his name on them. And he had been on TV on various reality television shows where he was sort of making fake business decisions presented as though they were real. And he was able to build up the idea that he was this savvy deal maker. And he, again and again, during the 2016 campaign, presented himself as somebody who was going to be a strong, effective manager. He was going to make great deals. He was going to improve our trade deals in ways that, as you say, would bring jobs back to the heartland. And that was really key, because it turned out that the industrial heartland is where some of the biggest breakthroughs he made came about.
Interesting note, too, that a recent Pew Research Center survey found that respondents favored by a large margin congressional Democrats over President Trump when it came to approaches to the environment, health care, Social Security, and ethics in government. To a smaller margin, Democrats were favored on foreign policy, immigration, and gun policy. However, President Trump showed a clear advantage regarding jobs and economic growth. So looking at this, what do Republicans need to be focused on in the next 24 months?
Well, there's a big debate among Republicans about that very question. And a lot of congressional Republicans in particular have looked at those numbers and said, we've got a good economy. People like how we're doing on the economy. Let's talk about the economy and jobs. And President Trump has been of the view that the thing that really gets his supporters' juices flowing, that excites them, is talking about immigration, talking about the media, talking about Trump's own political enemies and how terrible they are and how he is going to defeat them. And congressional Republicans think that's a terrible approach that costs them seats, but Trump's strategy is really to mobilize his core supporters rather than to persuade people in the middle. The fact is that there are intelligent analysts who look at the data and can make a case for either one of those things. But I think in the end, in modern American politics, the president defines the party, and Donald Trump is personally happier and more comfortable expressing his views on immigration and his anger towards his opponents than he is talking about dull and dry economic statistics.
And when you add on top of all of this the impeachment hearings, looking at the 2020 election, where would they start?
The impeachment is right now solidifying the views of most Americans about Trump. A lot of the people who said that they disapprove of the job that President Trump is doing have now come around to the view that he should be removed from office by Congress. The impeachment process involves a majority of the House and then two-thirds of the Senate voting to remove a president from office, which is a pretty hard standard to maintain. In fact, we've never historically actually had a president removed from office that way. Richard Nixon was going to be removed from office that way, and then he resigned so as to avoid having that done. But that's it. This was only sort of a half of an example of this procedure removing somebody from office. What's going to be interesting is seeing whether impeachment changes public opinion beyond having solidified people in their camps. So I think that a lot of the people who supported the president so far are still saying he shouldn't be removed from office, and the people who disapprove of him say he should be. But there's still the sliver of people in the middle. It's been a shrinking sliver because the parties have been more and more polarized, and American politics have been more polarized. But there is the sliver of people in the middle who go back and forth, can change their minds. They may agree with Republicans on some issues, agree with Democrats on other issues. And the question for Democrats is, can impeachment drive a message that pulls some of those people away from Trump and toward them?
Well, some say that that, in fact, is what the goal is. It's really not to impeach him to get him out of office, but so that he won't be reelected.
Well, I think that that is a goal of impeachment. I think that there are a lot of the people who want to remove him from office. They would be delighted if impeachment were to result in his removal from office. But at the same time, there's a fair amount of realism across the political spectrum that it is very hard to get two-thirds of the Senate to vote for such an outcome. In practice, you can't do that unless a lot of voters who picked Trump in 2016 decide that he needs to be removed from office. And so far, there's no sign of that happening.
Do you think President Trump, who supports non-traditional positions on immigration, for the Republican Party, on free trade, on withdrawing American troops from overseas, do you think he represents a transformational civil war within the Republican Party now?
So I think the Republican Party is suffering from a little bit of an identity crisis right now, because Trump overthrew a previous Republican establishment and set of ideas, but he didn't really replace them. So he didn't campaign in 2016 with a detailed agenda of his own, even on such signature issues as trade and immigration. And he hasn't really pursued a single coherent and dedicated policy in these areas. He's been much more of an impulse-driven person. And so I think the future of the Republican Party is very much up for grabs. And if Trump loses in 2020, or if he leaves office in 2024, I think the future definition of the Republican Party is going to be in question. And some Republicans are going to want to say, let's go back to the way things were before Trump. I'm not sure that that is really going to be possible, because I think part of what Trump was responding to was that exhaustion I was talking about of the old Republican agenda, the way it no longer fit with the times and the circumstances that most people, including most Republican voters, are living in. So I think what the Republicans are going to have to do is feel their way toward a new approach, maybe one that combines what they stood for before Trump with some of what was revealed by Trump's victory. But that's a tall order. It's going to be hard to do, and it's especially going to be hard to do because whether he wins or loses in 2020, Trump personally is likely to continue to be a factor in Republican politics.
And also just wanted to wrap up with this one last question. Looking at the future of conservatism, where do you see that, and how do you think the younger generation views it?
So I think Republicans and conservatives have a big challenge in front of them, particularly with young people who have been trending more and more to the Democratic Party and to the progressive movement. I think what Republicans have to do is to take some conservative insights and dispositions. We prefer decentralization, we prefer limited government and markets, and we've got to apply them to today's circumstances in ways that people find compelling. If it's just a matter of guarding a dusty textbook into the future, that is something that is going to be less and less relevant to people and is probably going to fall flat, especially for young people. If it is just about protecting an old vision of America that is changing, particularly a white version of America as the country becomes browner and blacker, that is also not going to work. Whether the Republican Party can adapt to changing circumstances like this is, I think, a great open question. And Trump, in some ways, has advanced that project of adaptation, but in some serious ways, he set it back.
Okay, well, of course, we could go on with our discussion as there's so many different facets to this subject, but we'll have to end on that note. And I would like to thank our guests for providing a very interesting insight into the Republican Party, Ramesh Panuru, visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and thanks to our panelist and my colleague, VOA senior correspondent, Brian Haddon. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America is produced in Washington. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Kim Lewis, your host for this special edition of PCUSA. And be sure to join host Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.